Okay, so welcome everybody to this first session of the Digital Arts Research Group. We're very excited to launch this research group. We're going to have a theme this term, which is art and financialization, and the themes will change term after term. So keep an eye on our program for the next terms. But for the moment, I've left a few flyers here if you want the program for the rest of the term. So help yourself. We'll have two meeting sessions in 2 weeks' time and 4 weeks' time, and then in 6 weeks' time, and then the last session will be an artist talk. And today we're very pleased to have Professor Julian Stalapas, and I will let Beat introduce.
Yes, I mean, two other points. We're going to pass around a little sheet of paper, just if you could put down your name and email address so that we can spam you with future events. And also we are required to note down the number of people who are present. So if you don't want to be on the mailing list, just maybe make a cross next to it. And the other point is that after the talk at 7 p.m., we're going to go for dinner at the Rice Boat restaurant. I've booked us a table with a few extra spots, so if you're interested in coming along, just let me know after the talk. So, but now I'm delighted to introduce Professor Julian Stalapas, who will be giving the first talk of our term. Professor Stalapas is one of this country's most noted authorities and indeed critics of contemporary art world. His books include Gargantua, Manufactured Mass Culture, High Art Light, and Art Incorporated. And as you can tell from these titles already, these are quite incisive takedowns of the contemporary consumer culture and the art world, and indeed of the economic system which sustains the contemporary art world. Of his most recent interests, I should mention Professor Stalapas' work on documentary photography as a curator, writer, and photographer himself. His recent book in 2013 is Memory of Fire, based on an excellent biennial at Brighton on documentary photography and war. But today, Professor Stalapas is going to talk to us about digital art and his 2007 exhibition, Art and Money Online. So please join me in welcoming Professor Stalapas.
Thanks very much. Is this on?
Yeah. Oh, you can turn it on. That should be on now.
Okay, can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks very much, Viv, for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here in Cambridge. And I'm going to talk about an exhibition that I curated, Art and Money Online, indeed. I hope you can see these slides okay. The screen's quite small. If any of you want to move forward, you might want to. Well, anyway, this imagine looking up at a night sky that's also a live representation of the global stock market. Each star represents a traded company. Stars cluster together or drift apart, grow strongly or faintly, and change colour depending on the movement of their stocks and the intensity of their trading. This is Black Scholes' Stock Market Planetarium, work by Lisa Ortega-Gaynor and Joshua Portway. Imagine, too, that at the time of its first display, viewers from their beanbags on the floor, staring up into the dome projection, could see the effects on the star field of the dot-com crash. So this was one of the works that was in the show Art and Money Online in 2001 at Tate. Tate had not then quite split into its two London arms. It was a small show that I curated, and I want to just talk about the different elements of it and about the trajectories, perhaps, of the work into the present. It came out of a Paul Mellon fellowship I had at Tate for a year, to develop a show, and as it turned out, a book, Internet Art, which came out a couple of years later. At the time, Tate was undergoing quite a lot of flux, a great deal of change. It was indeed in the process of its splitting into these two London venues, Tate Modern and Tate Britain. And it was a very interesting time, different competing curatorial models, for one thing, a lot of uncertainty, changes in the scale and the budget of the show, and indeed its location, whereas happened as we went along. So the result was far from my original vision, which was really to have a larger show in which there would be some works of installed gallery work, but at the center, basically an internet cafe, where people could experience net art, as it was then known, live, and also because many people found it rather difficult to deal with and navigate and understand, rather than to have exhibition guards, to have assistants who could explain things to you if you needed it. Anyway, that didn't happen. Instead, it was a small show of three installed gallery pieces. Now, remember, this was all pre-social media, pre-broadband, and largely pre-wireless. For most people, they experienced the internet through dial-up modems, charged by the minute on your phone bill, and with computers physically plugged in. Doonesbury, at the time, just sort of entering into this field, gave a nice idea of the experience. The net was growing explosively, as it had since the mid-1990s with the introduction of easy-to-use web browsers. But still, in a sense, it was specialists with some technical awareness needed of its users. And internet art compounded the elitism of that technology with that of the art world in a mix that many people find either off-putting, elitist, just incomprehensible, or aesthetically null. And there was, of course, much prejudice, not least from the art world itself, and that was a long-lasting thing. I mean, I think it's Manovich who's written about the contrast between what he calls Turing world and Duchamp world and the completely different ethos of each. And it's only really begun to erode and break down in recent years, I think. In the past, 3 to 4 years, I think, perhaps you might say, 5. So, as I say, the show held up three gallery-designed works as contrasting models of art world engagement with the internet. So one of these was Redundant Technology Initiative, a Sheffield-based group offering what they called no-cost technology to time-rich but money-poor people in that long, depressed region, which had not at that time recovered, or if it has ever recovered, from the Thatcherite assault on the industrial economy. So they made a community computing space or set one up, and users of the computer centre who helped out there earned not money, but Redundant Technology Initiative credit slips that could be set against the centre's fees. So it was an idea of a creation of a small alternative microeconomy, a bit like a limited form of a let scheme. So they used open source software, of course, donated old hardware. A lot of it was, pointing to the redundancy, the rapid redundancy of computer hardware, and bartered labour to achieve their no-cost result. It related to debates about open source, but also about the character of online labour, gift economy, payment, or more often the lack of it, and exploitation. Now, the gallery showing, and I'm afraid I must have installation shots of this show somewhere. This is not it, this is not Tate. But they're probably on film, and I can't find them at the moment. So, show you how long ago it was. Yes. And Tate didn't seem to make any. So the gallery showing, which was of a piece, was of this piece, was openly a form of advertisement for their community activities, and that's the way they saw it. And they did a kind of animated video, a work across the screens. And the ideal, of course, was that labour, activity, learning, coding, etc., came to produce a new and radical environment of collective solidarity, at least within this community space and in offering facilities to its users who would otherwise be cut out of participation in this technology. Another work was by Thompson and Craighead, who had become quite well known even at that time by working on a kind of net anthropology, if you like, mining the popular areas of the net, again, pre-social media, and marrying it with various forms of computer display and sometimes computer dysfunction. Pet Pages from 1997 is quite a good example of this. It doesn't function anymore, which is terribly sad. If it did, what happened when you launched it is that it would open hundreds of windows across your computer screen, each individual browser, as you can see, Netscape windows. And you keep on chucking these things up faster than you could click them away. And each of them connected to somebody's pet page. And then Thompson and Craighead had produced these little codes to point to various elements of it. But the fundamental thing was to do with the with all these celebrated pets. As with many online works of this kind, they decline quite quickly. The links go dead for one reason or another. And also they often relied on the exploitation of particular browser vulnerabilities, which would then disappear in the upgrade and so on. So this is a work that no longer can be seen live, fortunately. For Tate, they did a work called CNN Interactive Just Got More Interactive. So this is working with live pages from the CNN website, which people could browse through in the gallery. And as you can see, they also get the choice to choose an audio mood to go with whatever story that they're looking at. So you get a cross, as I said, between a sort of news site, and they're very cheesy downloaded Muzak tracks from the internet, right? Again, I can't play them for you, unfortunately. And the work is, it claims to be archived on Rhizome, but it doesn't work either. So it's another one that's gone by the by for the moment. CNN gave the user, the work rather, CNN, gave the user of this sculpture installation the option to choose from these tracks and then to play them publicly in the gallery. So you would stand at this plinth and see this screen and the projected screen and then choose a track or choose not to. And all this raised a number of issues, obviously to do with the nexus between news and entertainment, which was a much more of a subterranean issue then than it is now. Also, as with many works of net art, it pointed to the paucity of online interaction. There appeared to be an offer here of something rich, but often the options you were given were all equally vacuous. And of course, the old contention of if a viewer is being or a user is being asked to participate in a work, to what extent are they being manipulated by that work? A contention which goes back at least to Jack Burnham's thinking about contemporary art in the 60s. It was also to do with the difference between the experience of individually experiencing work online and collectively experiencing it in the gallery setting. How did that alter behaviour? What was the experience like of operating this work in front of others, either friends or strangers? The ironic use of the plinth and Tate's sparse, dignified gallery space to frame low material and encourage play is something we've seen a lot of since. Superflex's current Turbine Hall installation, but also Carson Hall's slides and many other works. But Tate was a lot more straight-laced then. It has changed very, very radically since. And this was, as I was saying, with this bifurcation of models of curation as well as of the physical building itself, this was just beginning. So the third work was, one we've already seen, Ortygena and Portway's Stock Market Planetarium. It was most radical in terms of its programming. I mean, these were all commissions, in a sense, for the exhibition, in terms of the sheer amount of work that they had to put in to making this thing work. There was a lot of hardcore programming involved. But arguably the most conservative in terms of its installation and experience. So, to visualize the global stock market as a star field projected on this domed ceiling, each star is a stock which burns brightly or dimly depending on the intensity of its trading. The larger stars are also larger companies and so on. They also produce constellations through the trading. So companies that were moving in the same kind of direction would tend to cluster as constellations. So the effects were quite extraordinary, obviously, through the dot-com crash, when a lot of stocks were moving in the same direction. They also include little artificial life creatures, sort of virtual stockbrokers, which feed off the trading and try to evolve to predict the location of large trades. So these were creatures which were born, lived, and died. The length of their life and whether they had enough energy to reproduce with other artificial life creatures was dependent on how much food they managed to obtain from being in the right place at the right time to feed off the trading activity. Okay. Well, there are a lot of issues involved in this. The spectacle of capital itself, in a sense. The idea of the difficulty of cognitive mapping, you know, Jameson's stuff about how it is that we can't see capital. This is an attempt, in a sense, to see at least one aspect of it. All larded with a good deal of irony, but also with the prospect of producing a useful and profitable tool, both in the overall visualization of the field, but particularly in the idea that these artificial life creatures might actually begin to have serious productive, predictive power. In the way it was displayed, I mean, there have been various iterations of this work since, and in some of them, as here, the stars have been named, and you can work out more or less what's going on. More typically, at Tate and in a recent display, Big Bang Data at Somerset House last year, there were limits to user knowledge, and you just see the unannotated star field. So what you're seeing, in a sense, is a sublime spectacle of what is for the ordinary user ungraspable activity. The piece was also very expensive in terms of the projection, the dome, the sort of technical requirements, and it was reliant on sponsorship, which came from Reuters. And there was a very curious episode. So I showed up to the launch, and I'd written a board more or less laying out my brief interpretation of the exhibition and, you know, the various works on show. And there was a board next to it, which I'd never seen before, which was the Reuters sponsorship board, and which they came up with their own interpretation of what I'd done, which was diametrically opposed to mine. It was all about the white heat of new technology or something of that sort. So that was one of the prices to pay, I suppose, for this particular work. So, as I say, an immersive, in a sense, traditional, passive, non-reproducible work, offering a quite passive user experience from the beanbags. Okay. So that's the three works in the exhibition. The book I wrote at the time, which came out a couple of years later, was a broader study of internet art. And it came out, obviously, from quite a bit of reading, especially of the discussions online, but also especially from talking to artists and theorists. And it saw the new art as a fundamental challenge to the restrictive practices of the old art world, that exclusive ownership and control were being challenged by unownable, copyable, and above all, alterable art. That what was expensive was being offered generally for free, and that and that methods of monetizing it were pretty much immediately hacked and challenged in that way. That the mainstream art of what was still then very deep in the years of the sort of neoliberal freeze and was generally very apolitical or cynical, was giving way to an art which was much more explicitly political, quite explicitly avant-garde too, often tongue-in-cheek perhaps, but nevertheless touching on older practices which would have been once have been anathema, and activist too. That the individual was more often being replaced by collectives, or at least by people who insistently shared and altered each other's work, and that the social exclusivity of the art world was being replaced by something much more open. One of the net art pioneers, Vuk Sausage, talked about this amusingly. He said that he became very shocked when his work first started to get drawn into the gallery, and he started to hang out with fine art people, high art people, rather than the online crowd. And he said that the two models were obviously completely different in a sense. He says that with the online crowd, I will talk to anybody unless they give me a very good reason not to. Whereas the rule seems reversed in the art world, that you only talk to anybody, only talk to somebody if you know exactly what you want. Well, much of what I wrote in that book seems too optimistic in retrospect, so I want to look a bit at the legacies of the model of each work into the present. The process in each may be thought of as a different aspects of monopolization, I think. So to go back to redundant technology initiative. Open source software, of course, has been highly successful in many respects, particularly in terms of it constitutes the apparatus in which the internet itself runs. But proprietary software, while it's increasingly difficult to sell, except to specialists, produces its profits in other ways. Open source software has yielded in the collective sphere to the heavily surveilled and marketed social media silos. So there's a monopoly at the level of deeply guarded proprietary algorithmic software. There are many secrets that surround that, not least its efficacy in terms of even what it's meant to do, which is to commercialize our every impulse. Free time is also monetized in hard conditions in micro tasks, click farms, mining operations of various kinds. And of course, there is art world visualization of this. Boris Kukovich is a student of mine who's here, has been working, doing very interesting work on Yuri Patterson, and in particular his work with Amazon Mechanical Turk workers, I don't know how many of you know about this, but these people are take on sort of micro tasks, which are given by employers and for micropayments, which they may or may not receive. And Patterson's trying to get a visual view on this, I suppose, through a work called Outsourced Views, Visual Economies, by asking these users, as the task for which he's paying, to give them either videos or photographs of the views from their windows. So it's a way, in a sense, of trying to visualize the new factory. There's been a what might be called a perversion of Richard Stallman's famous free, as in free speech, slogan about open source software. This is a he said, think free as in free speech, not free as in free beer, although often people think about free software as free as in free beer. And this is something that Superflex played on with their free beer installation here shown at the Taipei Biennial in 2008, which was actually offering free beer, as well as a free recipe to make your own beer, which is more on the Stallman mode. So here you have, instead of the idea of software as a form of free speech, which can be read, modified, you know, to suit you, we have a manipulating system, secret, geared to consumption and swift redundancy, in which the spectacle is intensified and made, sort of seeps into momentary aspects of life and is made operable. David Garcia, the pioneer of tactical media, comments that the techniques of tactical media, you know, the ideas of thinking out how it is that you use software to form new collectivities, were taken and commercialized by social media. That's very true. The net art practices of hacking, in Mackenzie Walk's sort of broad sense, are still very much in evidence, but the collectivity of tactical media has been monopolized, not only by the monopoly of the algorithm, but also, of course, by the monopoly of the agglomeration of large numbers of people. But the more people you have piled into your site, the more able you are to monopolize attention. And the resultant collective is, as we well know, far from utopian. Okay, to go back to Thompson and Craighead. So the charge of the CNN work was to take the mainstream authoritative news site and to play up its entertainment and design aspects to get viewers to think about the framing functions of the news and its emotional manipulations. There's since obviously been a breakdown, a rather profound breakdown, in trust, authority, and even the idea of the mainstream itself, as far as news goes. And you see this plainly through social media and the kind of entertainment news nexus that is in full flow there, but also in the extreme reactions of the mainstream press, or the printed press, I should say, to post-truth, partisan infotainment, you know, and all the rest of it. I mean, it's not as if this is entirely new, it has to be said. There's the kind of very detached relationship to truth of the Daily Mail goes back quite some time. But you know, there's something about the, it's become quite extreme and, you know, hysterical, if that's the right term to use. So it's now less pick your own soundtrack than pick your own propaganda arm, and indeed to help make it too, you can do that. There are no illusions in this, helpfully, and it has a large upside that the failing of the neoliberal centre has brought previously untouchable topics and policies into discussion. So actually here, through the actions in part of monopolised social media channels, we've had a breaking of the mainstream news monopoly on attention. Thompson and Craighead's amused detachment around the time of art and money online has become adapted to a more dangerous situation in many works, but I'll pick one out here. A generative geolocated film on war, which uses Google Earth to zoom in on particular, it's a video, but a generated video from found materials. So all of its elements, photographs and video, are found online, and as in are the comments and so on that you see displayed. And so this was a short film about war from 2009, in which they explore, well, in a sense, spectacularized warfare. Um, There's something else, though, I think, which is that, and it's an obvious point perhaps, but the very widespread alteration of material, online material via memes, it's as if the modest intervention which Thompson and Craighead were making in the Tate Show and in many others of their works, like so many artistic techniques, have become near universal in the social media world. This is partly a matter of de-skilling and reskilling, I suppose, partly a matter of the way in which social media sites allow people to have, ordinary people to have, audiences. And it's something that, you know, Hugo Stahl has pointed to very eloquently in the idea that so many of these artistic techniques, which were considered quite abstruse and you know, confined to the art world, have sort of broken out and just become part of the social media scene. In Ortegener and Portway, perhaps you see some form of prefiguration of what's become known as post-internet art, or spectacular works that draw on and use the internet, that function as objects largely as traditional artworks do in terms of exclusivity, expense and control, but are nevertheless utterly dependent on the internet in various different ways. One of the things that's been associated with is branded artists, and you can't accuse Ortegener and Portway of that, but we'll come back to branded artists in a bit. The work of the Robin Hood Asset Management Co-op, which is included in the readings for this this seminar, is one kind of specific riposte to work with open source software to force open financial expertise and swarming behavior to exploitation to those who have little capital. There's a certain irony here that the art markets, of course, are in deep crisis, that the much vaunted derivatives model of Black Scholes, which is played on the title of the Ortegener and Portway piece, had a role, a big role, in the financial crash of 2007-08 and all that flowed from it. The rise of post-internet art has, of course, been driven by financialization, a long-term and repeated process. I don't know how many of you have read Giovanni Arrighi's book, A Long 20th Century, but he goes through various long, century-long, or more than century-long cycles of accumulation and then financialization cycles, touching on Venice and Genoa, and then Amsterdam, and then London, and then New York. With some interesting observations about what comes next. And it's interesting, too, that in all of those cycles, part of what's happening is that there's too much capital being produced to productively reinvest in the industries or the trading that made it. So you've got all this spare capital floating around. Well, what do you do with it? I mean, one thing you might do is engage in warfare to try and seize other people's goods, okay, or territories. The other thing that regularly gets done is that you invest in assets of various kinds, particularly works of art. Right? So what we're seeing now, in a sense, in the inflation of asset classes is kind of classical and predictable capitalist stuff, if rather more extreme in certain ways than previous cycles. The other thing he says is that cycles get shorter and they intensify. Okay, and so the financialization process is something that goes back, you know, the current wave, right back to the times of the 1980s, of Ronald Reagan and Thatcher and so on. And it regularly leads to, Arrighi says, to this idea of a golden age for the elite, which is certainly the case. You know, the Edwardian era, the elite was just great, not so great for everybody else. But of course, they're the ones who have the loudest voices. They're the one who tends to define the way in which the era gets seen. And since 2008, deep economic dysfunction and even more intensified difficulty of knowing where to put your money has led to greatly increased asset prices and extensive hedging of investments using art. So this is true of the the commercial success of post-internet art, but also of contemporary art generally. This is Zheng Fangji's The Land, So Rich in Beauty, number 2, at the Ponte della Dogana, the private museum owned by François Pignon in Venice. So here art appears to defend its monopoly in the most traditional way. But actually the internet, and especially social media, I think have changed it quite a lot, and we'll come back to that a bit. So the radical moment of two of these moments of Radical Technology Initiative and Thompson and Craighead founded in monopolization of various kinds, which should hardly be a surprise, this being a standard capitalist operation. I mean, the last thing business people want, after all, is a free market. You can't make any money out of that. Monopolization, then, has been, in terms of the online realm, has been above all of social behavior and its manipulation. And the art world itself is a paradigm of monopoly. Insider trading, secrecy over pricing, demand, supply, these are all standard and subject to standard forms of manipulation. But the process has also brought about its own dysfunction and instability. So the artistic model of Black Scholes has shifted too. And I wonder if we can get at some of this by thinking about David Harvey's writing on monopoly. So for Harvey, monopolies are one of the ways, obviously, in which capitalists try to position themselves so as to exploit a rent on property that nobody else can. Land is one of the clearest examples. For example, a vineyard which sells a unique product. Nobody else can do that if you own it. But there are many others, including brands and, of course, artists and artist brands. This is Jeff Koons with his branded BMW in 2010. Yet, says Harvey, the monopoly is subject to pressures, both of which may be due to its very success. So it may become so special as to be carried outside of the commodity sphere entirely. Bockian Palace is Harvey's example, but most museum acquisitions are like this. And we see the owners of many artworks, even private owners, more as custodians than mere commodity holders. This has become became very apparent, I think, when a Japanese collector said that he was going to destroy a Van Gogh that he owned, have it destroyed on his deathbed or something of this sort, which caused a huge stink. So the idea that if it had been a BMW, no one would have cared particularly, but artworks of that kind seem to have a different status. Or in the opposite direction, that the monopolized good may become so run-of-the-mill as to lose its monopoly status. Harvey calls this a process of disnification. And this is common in artworks too. Through social media and the increasingly rapid, large-scale, standardized circuit of art commerce. And this is the newer, more powerful feature here, I think. Especially when one thinks about over the last decade, the sort of tenfold increase in the size of the contemporary art market and its uneven globalization. It partially threatens the monopoly status of art, but also I think it begins to threaten the first element too, the idea that one might start holding this stuff up as being so unique that it should be collected by museums, for instance. And the long crisis exacerbates the effect as artworks are used increasingly for purely instrumental purposes as financial tools. And the taste of very rich people is really strange, I think. You might describe it as normcore, if you know that term, of the many time poor and inexpert collectors who drive the market now. It's clearest with Banksy prints, which are hardly distinguishable from a poster, bar the signature, which confers huge monetary value. This is the Banksy Gallery down on not too far from Tate, actually, down in the South Bank in London. But these things, which really are a little more than posters, if they have a signature, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of pounds. If they don't, they're not. There are complaints even from the dealer collectors of a previous wave of popularization. So Charles Saatchi, of all people, mounted an assault on dealers and collectors recently as being vulgar and self-regarding. And influential US critic David Hickey, who's always saying that previously that the market will provide good work, noisily announced his retirement from writing criticism in disgust. On the grounds that art was too popular, he says, I miss being an elitist and not having to talk to idiots. So I think this is very much to do with the pressures of social media, of Instagrammable art, the ingestion of the rare object into the regular circuits of the attention economy. And it leads to skepticism about the mega art event, the art fair, the private museum, the blockbuster show. This is Hearst's show at Venice, courtesy of Pignot, of course. But it extends even to less commercial mega events, such as Documenta. Although on the opposite grounds, here of an excess of elitism, exclusivity, difficulty, and hubris. Right. So you don't seem to be able to win either way, at least when it comes to the expenditure of large amounts of money, I think, is part of it. So you have the highly unstable situation in which capitalism is visibly failing to maintain the social pact that it made a success of in the post-war years. And the novelty of the new monopoly arrangements produce all kinds of unintended consequences, such as Facebook activism, for instance. But art seems too widespread to be subject to monopoly in many ways. It's a feature of this. Ariella Azoulay, famously in the Civil Contract of Photography, made the notorious statement that photography is unownable. Right? And you kind of read that and you immediately think, well, of course it's ownable. I own some of it. Collectors own it. It's subject to copyright. And so on and so on. But there's a sense in which she's right. She's really right. It's become much, much clearer even since she wrote that book, I think. There's so much just circulating all the time in ways which the owners, one way or another, just don't control. This is JR's Inside Out project, which is one kind of example of that fairly unownable photography and its social media life. So people were asked to go into his photo booth and to make sort of high-quality selfies, basically, which would then be displayed in public places. And this is connected to the idea that everyone is an artist, or at least a brand. This is something that comes out strongly out of the post-media art debates, Gene McHugh and so on. And that interest may lie more in the collective and in openness than in unstable monopoly and the supposedly exceptional individual. So the strong pressure on the art world is that social media does not give weight to quality, depth, duration of experience, but to metrics of repetition and speed. And in this way, the pressures that apply to all commodified experience and goods bear down on the once protective enclave of the arts. And in this, rather than defend the old virtues, it may be more salutary to help undermine the monopolies of information, individualism, and ownership. That's what I have.